Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, Wi-Fi 6 promises to fix all the whiffies. China hacked so many Supermicro servers, Microsoft's new Surface Gear, and try out quantum computing for yourself. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 486, recorded on October 4th, 2018. China hacked a lot of server hardware.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit.
Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most delightful, most engaging, most affordable, and occasionally most travel-friendly hardware podcast in this universe or any currently unknown universe. I was looking at a contract the other day. They're funny, especially when they're for really obscure software applications. The chuckling you hear comes from Mr. Ryan Shrout, founder and chief dude at PCPer.com.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hello. Good to see you, Patrick.
Good to see you, sir. I did something cruel because I am a terrible and evil co-host, and you do not deserve this. But I'm going to do it anyway because I love watching your facial expression. Quick, Kevin, switch to Ryan. CES 2019, Lisa Su, keynote, AMD. How excited are you about CES 2019? That face. Oh, if you're not watching the video, it's the most pained expression I think I've ever seen on somebody that wasn't actively grieving for a lost family member. You're just holding that in, dude. I thought this was kind of fascinating because so many of these huge players have kind of walked away from CES the keynote has kind of gone from like Microsoft did it for years and then a couple people who have forgotten have done it. And now Lisa Su, AMD CEO, is going to be doing the keynote at CES, the big opening, you know, in front of thousands of members of the press. Are we going to see Navi, AMD's next generation GPU? Is it going to have, you know, ray tracing? I also want to quickly point out that some of the responses on YouTube when we were talking about the 2080 series, boy, people are really, really irritated at NVIDIA and ray tracing and RTX and their interpret, like, NVIDIA didn't invent this. We know that. You don't need ray tracing for gaming. No, but you don't need 3D for gaming, and we can all play snoods. It's been interesting to watch some of the comments. You're a fool if you buy this. Well, yes, that's why we told people to wait until there are actual games out there. But I digress. What do you think? I mean, do you think she's going to announce any new projects? I mean,
it seems like a big, expensive move
for AMD. Sorry.
It is. It's kind of a big deal. It's been a very, very long time since AMD has been at the forefront of any show like this. Bill Gates there forever. Intel CEO, whoever it was at the time, had a spot there, and it's a really I think a really cool thing to see AMD there, to see Lisa there. I was trying to remember back to the keynotes that I had seen in the past, like the actual true keynotes, not just like an Intel press conference or something, or a company press conference that is branded as a keynote, where it's like the actual opening keynote, and they tend to be a little bit more grandiose, a little bit more, here's the state of the technology world, right? As opposed to individual product announcements. There have been some of those in there, but there have been some of those in there, and it would be, I think, foolish of AMD to not capitalize on this opportunity to some degree. But what it wouldn't surprise me is if, you know, they maybe technically make the announcements the day before or a couple of hours before, so that she has something to reference. But I would expect her to have some kind of, you know, world's first something to say, right? Because you're going to have the entirety of the electronics industry watching you all at one time. So a very big opportunity for AMD and for Lisa herself, and hopefully they plan accordingly and can get the right messages in there. Yeah, it's a pretty big deal, right? AMD's on an upswing, and this is just kind of another indication of their new status.
Exciting stuff. China puts chips in supermicro servers. What's going on with this? I mean, this is essentially what Bloomberg's saying is that China reached into the servers of like 30 U.S. companies, stuff at Amazon, at Apple. Sorry. This is big.
Yeah, and it's worth noting right off the bat that Amazon has denied it, like, mm-hmm. pretty strongly that they had any awareness of this going on. And obviously all the sources for this story are anonymous government agency representatives or anonymous Apple executives or anonymous Amazon executives. But the general synopsis of this is that Supermicro, which is one of, if not the largest provider of server OEM technologies and capabilities to companies mm-hmm. around the globe, was either responsible or allowed the Chinese government to place a tiny, tiny, tiny microchip on board designs. And mm-hmm. This chip was apparently even small enough in some cases that it would fit in between PCB layers. So in terms of like even Whoa. Physically discovering it was pretty much impossible. And that this chip sat between the firmware and the processor for the post sequence and basically allowed it to insert code where it wanted to. And it could alter the operating system in a way that it would allow access to other computers and compromise the networks and a whole bunch of stuff. And a lot of this is the amount of logic you can put on a chip this small is obviously minimal. And so it really just kind of was a door opening for access to other things that way. And this story actually kind of goes back into like 2014 through 2015 through 2016. Remember Elemental, a company mm-hmm. that does video processing gear? They were apparently, you know, compromised by this because they were buying their servers from Supermicro and rebranding them, and Amazon bought Elemental, and apparently Amazon discovered this issue or some portion of this issue when they did their security analysis of the company before they bought it. There's other, you know, potentially problematic things in that Elemental as a company who was making the most advanced video processing technology was selling into the DOD. They were selling into all aspects of military and government institutions because as you would imagine, I don't think they said this in the story, but if you imagine an environment, a situation where you want really highly compressed, very fast video, it might be from like, say, a drone feed.
Maybe.
If you're flying one of those around. So there are a lot of implications here. Apple is implicated in this. Not that they did anything wrong, but that they had at one point 7,000 or 8,000 Supermicro servers running in their data centers. The accusation in the story from Bloomberg is that Apple discovered that basically the government went to all these companies, about 30 of them, that had mm-hmm. been they had traced back to being using to using these servers. They'd been compromised, and then they did it all very quietly because they didn't want to, you know, let the people on the other side know that they had figured out what was going on. And Apple slowly removed all of the Supermicro servers from its data center and replaced it. But when it did it, it, you know, it blamed it all on like pricing issues or contract negotiations or what have you. So it's a really good story to read. It is, as someone who is currently watching the TV show Homeland, it seems very familiar, right? The kind of the CIA right. spy era synopsis of it. But I think what I found most interesting about it is there are 17 or 18 sources that Bloomberg has in this, all of them anonymous, of course, but 17 or 18 sources that talk about, yes, this happened at Apple. Yes, this happened at Amazon. The government had these meetings in Virginia where they brought these companies in. They were able, the reason how they found all the companies that were compromised was that they found a system that had this. They figured out what machine it was calling home back to. It compromised that machine and figured out where all the signals it was getting were from. And that's where they kind of backtracked their way into these 30 companies. But Amazon is, posted their CIO, chief, I think it was their CIO, put out a post today on their website about nothing from AWS has ever been affected by this. We've never been contacted by the government. We've never found any trace of compromised hardware. Everything that they're saying is a fabrication, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the drama around the story might be more interesting in the long term, except for the fact that maybe all these networks have been compromised and secrets have been stolen and governments and whatnot. So that's been the whole day here. How about you?
Yeah, that's not exciting at all.
The story does a good job of going into things about like how a well-done hardware-level implant is significantly more damaging than any software, implementation of a hack, right? And, they go into as much detail as you can in a Bloomberg story, but there's a lot of information in here, so it's worth checking out.
Yeah, I mean, it's some of the stuff you look at. I am friends with a number of hackers and pen testers and security professionals, and we shoot tech thing in the Hack 5 studio, and it's amazing to realize, just giving a window into a piece of hardware onto a network or it's just frightening to comprehend what could be done with that. That's all I'm going to say. Yeah, it's a fascinating story. It's probably much more fascinating than our next story. Not to take anything away from the glory that is the next generation. I mean, it's crazy, right? The Surface Pro 6, Surface Laptop 2, and the Surface Studio 2. Not nearly as exciting as international espionage and embedding tiny little microprocessors in between the PCB layers and motherboards. But Surface Pro 6, 8th gen CPU. Jeremy did a quick synopsis of what's going on PC per. Core i5, Core i7, 16 gigabytes of RAM, 1 terabyte of storage, maxed out with the traditional 12.3-inch, 2736 by 1824 screen. When I say traditional, I mean 4x3. No USB-C, no Thunderbolts. It does have USB 3.0, mini DP, and micro SD. And I can't decide if that's because most of these are going into large organizations that don't want to transition, or because Microsoft just can't be bothered to get rid of that stupid port on the side of the Surface and replace it with USB-C. Did I say that? Was that the outside voice when I said stupid port? I don't like the connector for the Surface power supply.
You don't like custom proprietary connections?
That are impossible to find. I shouldn't. I'm saying that in part while I'm looking at the side of a Lenovo laptop that has USB-C, and then looking over at a Dell laptop that has at least a barrel connector that's non-proprietary, or the option of using USB-C. Surface Laptop 2, the modest battery upgrade, they're basically claiming 14.5 hours up from 13.5 hours, pretty much looks the same, also lacks Thunderbolt. I think the most compelling thing in this story is probably the Surface Studio, their new version of the Surface Studio all in one PC. It's using a 7th gen Core i5 or Core i7 processor, not 8th gen, but will include a GTX 1060 or 1070, and they're claiming the screen is 38% brighter. Same 4,096 levels of pressure. I guess maybe a new update that gives you 4,096 levels of pressure on the touchscreen. It's a really curious kind of upgrade. Is were you kind of disappointed by this, or this just I would have expected more ?
For the entire launch in itself, or this particular device?
The entire launch for itself. I mean, it's
I kind of agree, right? The changes are fairly iterative. I think I like the design shifts. You know, you've got newer, better hardware. I think the lack of Thunderbolt / USB-C on the laptop and the tablet is kind of it's like mind-numbingly dumb.
I think what bothers me about it, maybe.
Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense, right? Like, if you want to have, like, the Surface Go has both the Surface connector and a USB Type-C port that you can charge it with and or connect devices through, right? So, you know, if you wanted to have both, because you have these, maybe your argument is we have these legacy docks out there that a lot of people are still using, or we can push more power through, or we could do whatever it is. Sure, you can have that weird port on there that nobody really likes if you want. But to kind of just ignore the one connection that is kind of permeating through mobile devices and tablets and other notebooks seems backwards to me. And it doesn't strike me as something that Microsoft would do. It strikes me as something that Apple would do, which is very confusing. I think the products themselves are still really good. You know, I think the minimum spec, now the new minimum spec on the Surface Pro has eight gigs of memory instead of four, which I think is a nice uptick as well. But yeah, it's you know, I guess I like the matte black finish on them too. But yeah,
that's nice.
I'd still like to spend a lot of time with one of these, either the laptop or the tablet. Probably the laptop is still my form factor of choice, but.
I don't know. There's a lot of things I like about the Surface Pro. The performance, I think, has been a little bit disappointing with some of the more high-end configurations. But
yeah,
I may just be expecting too much for something so slim and so light. Something actually came out. Brief mention. I didn't realize that AMD was doing the Ryzen 5 2600H and Ryzen 7 2800H for laptops. These are 45 watt parts, so they're not exactly power sipping. But I'm kind of curious to see where those show up. Getting back on track, did you actually get a full? I mean, is this the first full non NVIDIA RTX 2080 Ti review that you guys have done?
For us, it is. Yeah. So I think last week we talked about the MSI 2080. This is now 2080 Ti from Asus. You know, higher clocks out of the gate. It's a large card. You can see by looking at the picture how much taller it is than the retention bracket.
The word beast wider comes to mind.
Yeah, they call it a 2.7 slot design, which gives them 20% better heat dissipation area, or 20% more heat dissipation area. I'm assuming that's compared to the Founders Edition, the reference design. It's very, very similar to the style we saw with Strix cards previously. Triple fan design. You've kind of got the RGB light strips that kind of surround each of the fan sections. You've got a BIOS button on the back. You've got all the same features that you would be used to there. It does do things a little bit differently in that you have two DisplayPort and two HDMI plus the virtual link connection there. I mean, geez, even these graphics cards have USB Type-C on a Microsoft. Come on. but the reference designs have three DisplayPort and one HDMI. Asus goes the direction of two HDMI. It does do two 8-pin power connectors instead of an 8 and a 6. And it does very well. I mean, it's a little bit faster out of the box in its performance mode. The difference between performance mode and quiet mode is really not dramatic in our testing, but Ken has a handful of benchmarks in there showing it faster than the 2080 Ti Founders Edition. In terms of thermals, that's where you see sound and thermals, you see more of an advantage, right? 33.9, that's that's pretty darn low for a graphics card running at full tilt in Unigine heaven there. And then in terms of clock speeds, you can see, let's see, what do we get on the overclock? We were able to do 140 megahertz offset, the max voltage offset that they allow, 125% power target, and able to be stable just over 2 gigahertz. Now, what you might recognize here is that, as it turns out, it's not really any different than the Founders Edition overclock of the 2080 Ti. And in fact, if you look at it, it's literally identical. Shows us that in reality, like, the board design, the cooler design, while it will keep the temperature of the GPU down, it doesn't really affect the overall performance, because the Founders Edition is now a dual axial fan as opposed to a blower style, and the voltage controls, power controls that NVIDIA has in its firmware and on their GPUs are substantial still, right? They're not allowing the board vendors to really do a lot of customizations, which means it's harder for them to differentiate, even with their high-end products, right, from EVGA, from MSI, from ASUS, or whoever. But you can see, if you look at the Unigine graph there, just underneath the one we just had up, that one there. So there is a pretty big temperature difference, right? If you look at the orange line, that's the Founders Edition at its peak. It hits just like 79°C or so after, you know, 5-10 minutes worth of gaming, whereas the ASUS card stays at around 67°C. So a pretty substantial difference there. The problem is we can't turn that into performance yet. I'm sure we'll see hardware mods and stuff for this, but for the average person that doesn't want to get a soldering iron out on their $1,200 product, you know, that part is a little disappointing. But overall, I think this card is only $50 more than the Founders Edition, right? So it's MSRP is $1,249, which is really high. But again, the Founders Edition is $1,199. And this is a cooler that is a step above what the Founders Edition cooler can do. It does that, and obviously, at the expense of size. It is 2.7 slot. It is significantly taller. So there are some trade-offs for it. But in terms of a retail product, a customized design, $50 extra is not really outside the realm of what we're used to seeing. In fact, it's actually pretty nominal. We'll have to see when they become available and what their prices are at actual, you know, Amazon and Newegg listings. But for now, based on the MSRP that ASUS expects them to see, that's pretty good.
It's interesting. I'm still kind of impressed when you just look at some of the numbers between the 2080 Ti and the 2080, where you're looking at some of the best benchmarks, as much as a 40%, I think, bump in performance. Obviously, I think I would have liked to have seen that from the 2080, but, you know.
Sure.
But I would say, like, where is it? Yeah, I mean, I think you're looking at like 37-38% dashes of the singularity. GTA 5, not as impressive, maybe. Still about 25%. But if you're going to spend all of the money on a 2080 or 20 series card, I should say, if you're going to spend all the money on a 20 series card and you're going to run 4K gaming, I almost feel like you should just break down and find the extra $400 to buy a 2080 Ti if you can. That said, I think the vast majority of humanity should just buy a 1080 or a 1080 Ti now while they're so cheap and wait to see what happens with RTX games over the next 6 or 8 months. But that may be an unreasonable thing to say given the cost of the cards.
Yeah.
I don't know. Seems just, I don't know. I don't want to say it's a bad time to be buying a GPU, but it would be frustrating to spend, you know, $800 or $1,200. Well, I guess, you know, $700 or $800 on a, you know, 10 series GPU, and then find there was a bunch of great RTX games next year. But I just don't see it happening. Is that wrong of me? Should we just wait to see what AMD comes out with? Will AMD reveal ray tracing at CES 2019? Ryan Schrott will be there in the front war, in the front row, staring up.
Close enough.
Wonder. He'll be in the first five rows probably. I don't know. I wish the price deltas between the 10 series and 20 series cards weren't so high. That's all I'm going to say. Xilinx Developer Forum, Xilinx CEO Victor Peng announced a new product family named Versal. It's Ken Addison writing for PC Per. This is kind of the final name of Project Everest, where they're doing the Adaptive Compute Acceleration Platform, or the ACAP market. What is this? I mean, is this a platform? Is this a chipset? Is this a very complicated, what exactly are they doing with this? It seems like a shmoo of processing.
It's a really interesting shift for them, right? So Xilinx is known for being an FPGA company, which is basically a dynamically programmable processor, and by hardware configurable, I guess might be a better way of putting it. It allows you to kind of customize the design of the processor at production or through updates on the fly at the expense of die area and sometimes power constraint too. But over time, what Xilinx has been doing is they've been integrating different IP into these processors, right? So they've worked with ARM for a while for people to be able to integrate ARM SoCs into their FPGAs so that they could do multifunction or have it be a command processor or whatever it has to be. And you could do that either with a drag and drop where you take an existing ARM core and place it, or you could integrate the ARM core capability into the FPGA dynamically through the function of the FPGA. And that would allow you to place maybe blocks where you thought they would be more beneficial. You could adapt the memory hierarchy. You could do all kinds of customizations to it. What this kind of product and segment represents for Xilinx is another step beyond that. If you look at what they call the ACAP, the Adaptive Compute Acceleration Platform, it's really just a name for what they believe is a processor type that has general purpose units, customized units, and then the typical FPGA functionality that allows their customers to really build custom tailored computing solutions, right? So there are, so if you look at a block diagram of this, which is very neat in all of its lit up glory, there is a scalar processing engine, which is a pair of Cortex A72 cores, a pair of Cortex R5 cores. R5 is the real-time part. So this is processors that are specifically designed to have latency as their minimum possible metric, right? So these would be things that, you know, you would want to be in self-driving cars, for example. You want them to be minimal latency. You have the adaptable hardware engine, which is the red section in the middle. That is the classic FPGA portion of these products. They, you know, re-architected foundational hardware fabric is what they call it, right? And so really you could design this to be a memory structure. You could design it to be a compute structure, all kinds of different things. And that's really where FPGA's value lies, is that if you have a custom algorithm, you can implement something faster than a general purpose processor or faster than a GPU could do, or just more specific to something for power efficiency as well. And then the intelligent engines are what are actually new for them. They have, well, the DSP is updated, digital signal processor is updated, but they've also added the AI engine in here as well, which is an array of vector processing units with direct attached memory. They didn't go into a whole lot of other architectural detail about what these are, but it is AI acceleration hardware. Think of it being analogous to the Tensor cores in NVIDIA GPUs or that Google is using in their TPUs, for example, something to that degree. But with a little bit of that customization from Xilinx in terms of how the memory hierarchy stuff works. And then there's protocol engines. It's got DDR4, HBM. It's got fabric interconnects between all of these different blocks. Essentially, what we're seeing is Xilinx branching out of just wanting to be known as an FPGA company. And instead they're saying, look, we're building a total solution that people can use in edge compute, in AI use cases, in networking use cases, in prototyping use cases. And their direct target is Intel and NVIDIA with these products, right? If you look at the performance data that they supplied and that Ken showed some of in here, they're comparing it to, you know, their AI compute capabilities next to a Tesla V100 and next to a Xeon scalable processor. So they have they're going after this market. Now they'll tell you that, you know, they'll say, and it's true that they have all these existing customers. This is one segment of it. They believe this is where all their growth is going to really shoot out from. But you know that there are other areas they're in. But this is kind of their long term goal. This is a dramatic shift for them and a pretty big bet for a roadmap. It was really interesting. I was out at this event this week in San Jose. And I got to talk to a lot of executives and engineers about what the plans were for it, and it's pretty interesting. The one caveat to it is that this is a second half of 2019 product, built on 7-nanometer TSMC, so advanced process node technology. But it is second half of 2019, so the landscape might shift between now then, and I'm sure NVIDIA will have at least one product for the AI inference market updated between now and then. So I'm very curious to kind of see how all that changes and what customers we see adopting the idea of the ACAP or the Versal in this particular instance. So it's a really interesting kind of shift, right, of major players.
A shifting of major players. Sounds like a good play. Not as exciting as that whole Chinese hacking story, but then again, what is?
Still not, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Among the many things in life I would prefer not be exciting is getting a mortgage. I'd like it to be calm. I'd like it to be chill. Home buying is terrifying. It's the biggest purchase most people will ever make. You're talking about getting a mortgage, like a 30-year commitment. And our friends at Quicken Loans, they want to make the whole mortgage process pain-free, trauma-free, anxiety-free. Don't sweat rising interest rates. Don't get too worried about the unpredictability of what's going on in the markets. Just think about the power buying process. That's what Quicken Loans is calling it. Step one, answer a few simple questions. They check your credit for pre-qualified approval. Step two, Quicken Loans, they verify your income, your assets, your credit. They do it in less than 24 hours. They give you a verified approval. They want to give you the strength of a cash buyer. Step three, once you're verified, you qualify for Quicken Loans' all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. This is slick. They lock up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. If rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. Either way, you win. It's the kind of thinking you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender. And it's the kind of thing that'll make buying a house a little less terrifying, a little less traumatizing. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. That's rocketmortgage.com/twit. We want to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Oh, my goodness. Something I was laughing about, although laughing is probably not the right word for it. The Wi-Fi Alliance is changing it up, man. Did you hear about this?
I did, yeah.
Wi-Fi 6.
I don't know what. Go ahead.
Okay, so if you found 802.11n, the 802.11ac, or the future 802.11ax confusing and complicated, the Wi-Fi Alliance is here for you. They have Wi-Fi 4. That's going to be 802.11n. That's the new name. The the Wi-Fi technology formerly known as 802.11n is now Wi-Fi 4. 802.11ac becomes Wi-Fi 5. 802.11ax becomes Wi-Fi 6. They're relabeling two previous generations of Wi-Fi, and they're announcing that 802.11ax is going to be Wi-Fi 6. I find it slightly fascinating that they've decided to do this now. This is tied into the launch of 802.11ax. So ASUS is going to launch, I love this, the super fast RT-AX88U wireless router. It's coming in mid-October. There's a whole story up on that on CNET. And it's going to launch in Singapore. And it's going to head out to the rest of the world is what Aloysius Lowe was writing on CNET. And it's the announcement was, 802.11ax, this router was announced earlier this year. They're promising up to 600 megabits per second, and the router's going to have like 8 gigabit LAN ports. This is a really breathy news coverage. They're going to use target wake time to schedule transmissions. The idea is that devices can, sleep longer, quote, before they're woken up to receive wireless packets. This is like a $600, or I should say it's going to be like $435 in the US. So it's a new high-end router. I don't know anything that's actually going to run with this. And it's funny, 802.11ax has been so on the down low. It hasn't, it seems to be coming slow. We don't have final approval until 2019, so I'm not entirely sure why ASUS would drop that router, even in just Singapore. You're looking at a spec that's not entirely full. It's designed to deal with client density. It's designed to deal with latency issues. This is... I'm kind of curious what's going on. I mean, they're not so much. I mean, it will be faster than 802.11ac, but the truth is speed is not the issue for most people or most environments. But what they are claiming is 802.11ax will deliver like four times as much data simultaneously across multiple clients and reduce latency by up to 75%. And it will be backwards compatible. Two drafts of it has already been rejected. The third one, I think, was passed in committee in July 1st of this year. Final approval, I think the final vote is going to take place in 2019. I'm very curious. It's not necessarily going to, it's not going to have more throughput than an 802.11ac device, which is like 1 gigabit per second. But the idea is that it's going to do a much better job of splitting that bandwidth across multiple connections.
Right.
It's still
the goal 20. is to have higher combined throughput of all devices.
Yeah. They're talking about like 75% less subcarrier spacing required, which gets into some really deep. It's still using the same 20 megahertz channels. But 802.11ax creates 256 sub-channels inside of those individual 20 megahertz chunks of bandwidth. I mean, I'm kind of really curious. The idea is that sub-channels will be divided into resource units so that you can talk simultaneously. Because one of the things about in the past, sub-channels are basically all of them were used in parallel to talk to one device. And then would hand it over. So,
right.
They're talking to like 9 sub channels simultaneously on 120 megahertz channel, or 74 on a 160 megahertz channel group. I'm really curious to see what the real world performance on this is. I mean, I think it just kind of comes down to that. Multi-user orthogonal frequency division multiple access, or MUOF. DMA.
OFDMA. That's right. Yes.
No. MU. OFDMA, not to be confused with OFDM or OFDMA. I don't know.
I think the rebranding to Wi-Fi 6 is better, right? Like, AXACN, BGA, A plus we've got DAD and AY, which are the 60 gigahertz options. Mm-hmm. Wi-Fi 6 makes a lot more sense, right? Like it's more easily understandable. We know that, hey, 7 will be better than 6. I mean, God, I hope so. And yes, it's just one less useless. I mean, 802.11ax is an unnecessary thing for us in the modern world. So go with the branding.
I don't know. I want to be excited about this. You know, certainly go from 802.11 to 802.11ac was a big deal. A lot of the mesh stuff, which is not the same as going to, you know, which is using like 802.11ac. I don't know. I think Wi-Fi 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 will be a lot easier to remember. I also feel like on some level, this is kind of a way to strike back against sort of the abuses of naming conventions that router manufacturers have been prey to over the last couple of years, you know, where it's right. A Wi-Fi 47,000, while ours is a Wi-Fi 53,000. Well, ours is a 64,000. You know what I mean? Where they're adding random chunks of bandwidth that aren't actually accessible simultaneously to an individual device. And adding those to give the total awesomeness of the router. I don't know. I am curious. I am compelled. I am also going to wait until 2019. I'm also kind of curious whether or not there's going to be, I don't think there's going to be any software upgrade path that is going to require new chipsets from our favorite mobile manufacturer. I think Qualcomm kind of owns the early chipsets on this, but we shall see. Windows 10 October 2018 update. What are the highlights on this one, man?
The biggest draw here is that this is the update that enables DirectX 12 ray tracing. Mm-hmm. So this is the OS update that allows the RTX features to work on the new RTX graphics cards. There was some experimental flags you could use in the April update and operate the DXR stuff, but now you don't have to do that. And so NVIDIA was out promoting this release, basically saying now the future is here for RTX and all that. And while it is a necessary step, last I checked, no ray tracing games were installed along with the Windows update, so there's still a significant step missing from that claim. They did some other updates. Let's see, the game bar, which I don't know if you've ever really even used it. I haven't done much with it. But it apparently it used to delay updating and rebooting during play sessions. You don't have to worry about that anymore. That's a plus that it will not try to do Windows updates while you're playing a game, I guess. Some of that logic coming into play, I guess. Audio controls can now be accessed in game, so you don't have to alt tab out to that and risk losing your gaming session. So they're doing some stuff to make it more gaming friendly. Right. But obviously DX12 ray tracing is the big flagship there.
Looking at a lighter and thinner laptop, it's funny, we were just looking at Dell's XPS 15 on Tech Thing, which is kind of a fairly sophisticated productivity or content creation laptop that's also pretty good for gaming, and just announced by Alienware this morning is the M15 sub 5 pound 15 inch gaming notebook. Not quite as sophisticated as the XPS 15, but certainly vastly more sophisticated than most gaming laptops, although we're seeing a lot of gaming laptops that are designed for adults that don't necessarily want to look like they're carrying around space hardware with them. Quad-core Intel Core i5-8500H or a 6-core i7-8750H, and overclocked. I like how Ken in the article on PC Pro put overclocked in parentheses GTX 1060 or a GTX 1070 Max Q. A 60 hertz TN or a 144 hertz IPS 1080p screen. I love the idea of the 144 hertz 1080p screen on there. Or you can do a 4K 60 hertz IPS panel. No G-Sync support that we know of. And Ethernet I would say it's got an Ethernet port built in, three USB 3.0 Type A ports, a Thunderbolt 3 port, HDMI 2.0, Mini DisplayPort 1.3. So a pretty impressive complement of ports on there. Starting price is going to be $1,300. I suspect the price on the fully kitted out 4K version with a 1070 Max Q will be painfully expensive, but I could be wrong. But
it'll definitely be more. The display options are interesting to me in that 1080p, 60TN, or 144 Hertz IPS, or 4K 60 IPS, but no G-Sync, which it's a little confusing. I'm gonna have to ask somebody about that, because it doesn't. Alienware is generally on the forefront of those types of flagship features, and it's got a 1060 and a 1070 Max Q in it, both of which obviously support it. 144 Hertz 1080p panel would be a perfect option for it. So we'll have to figure out if there's a spacing issue, a cost issue, or what it might be.
Yeah, or maybe that's, I don't know. It is kind of curious. We shall find out. I'm just going to read your line and then shut up. Try out quantum computing for yourself. Where are you going with this, man?
So D-Wave, which is one of the manufacturers kind of looking into development of quantum computing, announced a cloud service, essentially. If you don't want to spend $15 million to buy a D-Wave 2000Q quantum device, you can now rent some time through a quantum computing environment called Leap. It's an addition to a quantum cloud service that virtualizes quantum computing for anybody that wants to give it a shot. Leap allows anyone, this is great, allows anyone to sign up, giving them 1 minute of time on a cloud-connected 2000Q each month. While that doesn't sound like much, a key advantage of quantum computing is being able to solve in milliseconds problems like factoring large numbers, optimizing routes, or calculating molecular structures that could take traditional computers days or weeks. I just love the idea of you get 1 minute per month on this computer. They do provide documentation, videos, training materials, and a forum or community of some kind for the majority of developers that have never worked with quantum computing devices, which is, yes, pretty much all of us, so that you can try to figure out, when you get that 1 minute of time, maybe you can use it productively by having some code that works and some application that runs. And I think it's going to be pretty interesting. So they've got an open source software development kit called Ocean that can be used to build the apps for that computer. And then you just get that 1 minute of time to run it. Apparently this is also something that, let's see, who are the other two guys, IBM and Rigetti, offer online access to their devices as well. I mean, considering how few of them, exist on the planet, this is a pretty sensible way of doing it. And it will allow people to kind of figure out what the capabilities are. Rigetti is a Bay Area company. IBM, obviously well known.
Obviously well known.
I don't know how much it costs. They didn't give me a cost here. Let's see. $2,000 for 1 hour of access each month.
Well, there you have it. If you have to ask, you couldn't afford it anyway.
Looks like a bargain compared to the $100,000 NASA is charging Ford for access to its 2000Q in Silicon Valley. So, there's that. So if you want to spend $2,000, you can, do a hello world in quantum computing, Patrick.
I'm good.
Okay.
I'm not quite ready to
it would generate all of those characters at one time, though.
Yeah.
That's as far as my understanding of quantum computing goes.
Thanks. Let's put a pin in that. Yep. Oh, my goodness. More 2080 Ti board's going to be up for review, or are you sort of twiddling your thumbs until the 2070s show up?
We have another 2080. Yeah, that's true. They are supposed to be here soon. We do have a 2080, but no more 2080 Ti's in queue. But we have an EVGA 2080. And then, yeah, I mean, what'd they say, October 17th for the 2070? Something like that. Well, so
we've heard a lot of days, a lot of release dates for a lot of 20 series RTX GPUs.
If they're going to send them to us to review, we've got to be getting them somewhat soon. Or maybe they just don't care. I don't know. We'll see. We'll find out.
Well, it's not like they're not selling out all the ones they have currently, but we will find out. Oh, my goodness. Shannon got her hands on to the latest Alienware's latest gaming mouse, which oddly enough actually matches the Alienware case design and the Alienware headset. So as an Alienware influencer, she is fully kitted out with all of the Alienware gear. It was interesting, actually. The basic design is extremely similar to the previous generation mouse, but they did skinny it up a bit, which, given that her hands are considerably smaller than mine, made for a pretty big deal in terms of how she was handling the comfort level, I guess, and actually allowed her to change the way she was gripping the mice. She gets really deep into the whole sort of like claw versus resting, you know, mousing finger style. And I just sort of lay my hand over whatever mouse is in front of me and drag it around the table. But also, if you're kind of frustrated, if you're used to heavier mice and you're frustrated by some of the new gaming mice out there, or if you're looking for a gaming mouse that actually has the ability to adjust the throw weight and put some mass into it, this should be on the list you look for. I actually kind of got a little crazy this week. There was a power outage here in Alameda, which not only took out all of the electric in the town, it took out the cell towers, which was a little bit worse than I've had from a power outage in a long time. I also pointed out some flaws in my current UPS configuration and actually some of our disaster planning. But if you're curious about that, do yourself a favor, go over to techthing.com. That's TEKTHING.com. And please, if you haven't been there, go to PCPer.com. And if you're thinking about building a new PC, go to the PCPer.com/leaderboard. And you'll find a lot of Asus there, which brings me back to the excitement of CES 2018. Both Ryan and I will be going. If you are a vendor, feel free to contact us or tweet at us at Ryan Shrout, at Patrick Norton on the Twitters. And I just want to thank each and every one of you for listening. But before we leave, I want to remind you, twit.tv/Twitch. That's the place to go to find all of our older episodes, information on how to subscribe, and all kinds of interesting stuff. It's part of the Twit Network, if you didn't know. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.